Rustbelt Capital is an elite Ohio-based private equity firm with a specialization in long-term, high cash flow multifamily investments. If you're looking for long-term recurring income, you should check out Rustbelt Capital. From their approach to managing risk, to the locations they invest, the product quality they provide, this firm is serious about what they do, which is why the owners of Rustbelt Capital invest their money in every deal they take on. Review their case studies by visiting rustbeltcapital.com. That's rustbeltcapital.com. Once again, rustbeltcapital.com or email investor@rustbeltcapital.com.
There is no time since World War II that we can find an instance of multifamily being 25% discounted from peak in an absolutely high quality market with the stock market at all time highs. And the reason for that is COVID. Black swan events change the way that people think.
Hello, left fielders. Welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast. Our community is focused on networking and education to help people invest passively and think differently. Let's go.
This is Paul Shannon from Red Hawk Real Estate, and you're listening to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast. I'm your host today, Chad Ackerman, sitting in. And with us today, we have our repeat guest, Neil Bawa. Neil is known as the mad scientist of multifamily. He's the president and CEO of Go Capitus Investments, a firm specializing in building apartment buildings, student housing, and self-storage properties in high-quality markets nationwide. He's also the founder of a real estate community with over 30,000 members. And Neil was a guest with us here on the podcast in episode 71 back in July of 22. So yep. Neil, welcome back to the podcast again. We appreciate you coming on again.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back in left field. And, you know, what an interesting time to be having this conversation, Chad.
All the perfect reason to have you back on the podcast and do maybe some comparisons to where life was in 22. We usually start out with a journey. You gave us your journey back in 71. Maybe you can give us like a 5-minute spiel, at least for those that haven't heard the other podcasts, but they can always go back and listen to more detail with the other one as well. But a little bit about it.
Absolutely. I'm a technologist, computer science engineer, live in Silicon Valley. I'm very steeped in data science. That's my major. And I focus on using very large amounts of data, so big data, to do forecasting in various parts of real estate with, you know, multifamily being sort of the largest specialization. But we've invested in 8 different asset classes, roughly 1,000 investors, a little over 1,000 active investors. The portfolio is a little under $1 billion when all built. About half of it is development. The other half of it is value add in various different areas. And, you know, I did real estate investing for 10 years by myself, both building and buying, you know, different kinds of real estate before I jumped in. And the primary reason was because I live in California. I was paying 53% of my income in taxes. I was in the highest tax bracket. And so the goal there was to basically bring my taxable income down. And we did that over 10 years. And I started by basically writing data science for real estate courses and putting them on various websites. The one on udemy.com went viral. I currently have 13,000 students taking that particular course. And number goes up and down, but there's 13,000 taking it right now. So I realized that there's actually a lot of nerds and geeks and dorks like me that are very interested in the data science of real estate and the demographics of real estate. That's something that's very interesting to them. And so now we publish a huge amount of content, dozens of articles, dozens of, you know, case studies, and entire massive webinars on the data science of real estate. We issue predictions every year in January, and then the following year we tell you how we did on those predictions. Roughly 10,000 people watch that particular webinar each year. So, you know, that's a collection of nerds that are very interested in data science.
Well, what I love about the data science side of things is real estate is a very emotional transaction.
It is.
And the data side of things it takes the emotion out of it when you can boil it down to the data side of things. To me, that's how I approach it anyway.
Yeah, I have a little anecdote to tell you on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, please.
I have a absolutely brilliant person working for me. His name's Daniel, and Daniel's been doing development all his life, right? So he's, you know, in his late 40s, but I think he got in there when he was like 20 years old, and he's done and absolutely has an astonishing resume in terms of the sort of development that he's done. And so when he was hired at my company, he was offended by one of the things that we were doing. So I had a team of four people. So it was Daniel, it was a full-time underwriter, it was a you know, a zoning and development expert, and then an administrator, right? So these four people, and their only job is to basically buy tens of millions of dollars of land and get it zoned and permitted and entitled for, you know, development. No, somebody else does the development. They just do all the pre-development. And so he was offended by the fact that he would come in and he would basically say, okay, well, you know, he would present, his job was to present five pieces of land in a 90-minute meeting to me. And then basically it's Shark Tank, right? So we'd critique him and typically we'd pick maybe one to make an offer. So if we made one offer a week, I was pretty happy. And there were many times when he'd come in and say, this is an insane piece of land. It's absolutely incredible, blah, blah, blah. It's going to do really well. And basically I would say no. And he would be like, Neil, I mean, I have 30 years of experience at this. So I said, okay, let's do this. Let's run an experiment. You've got 30 years of experience. Every single time you present a property to me, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to give it a numerical number with 10 being, you know, the best property and one being, you know, the worst property. Obviously, you probably wouldn't present one with ones or twos, but you, you know, you might have some fives and sixes and sevens out there and also some nines and tens. You do that. And then I have this underwriter who has clear instruction that no one in the company, including the CEO and owner of the company, is allowed to influence him, right? Because he's using the data science and we built this system where, you know, he ranks these properties. Basically, at the end of that process, it was very humbling for Daniel. There was actually no correlation between his gut feel and investor returns. There was no correlation. So even though he had 30 years of experience, and now he swears by it, he says, the best thing about your company is the fact that underwriters, even the owner of the company, cannot influence them or have a conversation about potential returns. And so he believes that's the biggest thing that he's learned in the company, right? And 30 years of experience, and he still understands that there was really no correlation between his gut feel and returns.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I think the metric side of it helps you to be more disciplined, helps you not to chase a shiny object and so forth. And I know that's not where we were trying to go with the conversation, but I love the story.
I want to add one last thing, right? Doesn't mean that Daniel's, you know, words are not important, because when he visits a site, he sometimes drives around it. So I'm not saying that data science takes that out. We actually require that for all of our sites, we do both a physical drive and then we do a Google Maps 3D drive, right? So that's different. That's you understanding the area around it. So, you know, at one property, the area could have a Starbucks and a Whole Foods right next to it. And another one could have a strip club and, you know, and you know, strippers, you know, or prostitutes hanging around on the corner, right? That kind of gut feel is extremely, extremely important. But what we say to people is you have to add that to the data, right? Yeah. Let the data choose first. And if the data says this is a 9 or a 10, then we go in, then we apply our eyes and our experiences to it and use that to eliminate.
Yeah, it's your filter process. Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's great. Awesome story. I love hearing that kind of stuff, and it definitely hits home to me. What we wanted to bring you back on to talk about was relating to kind of as you started out with, let's talk about what has changed since you were here in 2022. When you were on before, we talked about hybrid work. We talked about interest rates and cap rates, where America was moving, what, you know, different stories like that. Can you talk about what you're seeing now, year and a half later, in this American industry of real estate investing that has changed quite a bit, I feel like, since then, and how you're reacting to those changes this day and age?
Well, COVID has turned out to be a true, true black swan event, not just in the short term, but also in the midterm and long term. So, you know, obviously, the most horrible part of COVID is 7 million worldwide deaths, and there's not much that we can do about that. you know, we're sort of, you know, at this point, the world's gotten through it, but it came at a horrible, horrible cost. But I think that when you, for a moment, put that aside, what are the other things that COVID has done? Well, it has dramatically changed the world in many different ways. So the first thing that has happened is that COVID basically trained tens of millions of CEOs on how to run their company from home. And even though the majority of those companies, employees have gone back to work, hybrid work has become extraordinarily established at a certain level. And that level sort of varies. It varies depending upon the kind of field, you know, whether you're, you know, a tech company, then there's higher level of hybrid work. You know, if you're a banking group, then there's a much lower level of hybrid work, but it's still there, right? So even banking companies are now letting their employees work one day a week. So on average, the average white collar worker in the United States is now working one to one and a half days more from home. And that has had an incredible impact, not just in terms of, you know, what that means for real estate, but in terms of how people work. Where do they work? Where do they live? What are their choices? And so the number of knock-on effects of COVID are in the thousands. I mean, I could spend an entire day listing just all of the things that have changed and the way that, you know, the way that we make homes is changing, right? So for example, having a home office has now become a bigger deal, right? So the design of single family homes that are being built by KB Homes today is different from pre-COVID because they no longer build homes that do not have an office cubby. Right. In most homes, it's not a full scale room yet, unless it's a 4 or 5 bedroom home. But if it's a 3 bedroom home, they're now basically redesigning those homes to have an office cubicle. Right. So, you know, so and they design in such a way that there's the wall behind you because they're keeping Zoom in mind. You know, they want to make sure people are not walking behind all of that stuff. So home design has changed. Right. And one of the greatest sectors of all time in real estate has been completely demolished or decimated, and that's the office sector. So, you know, we know that multifamily is the largest sector in real estate, not counting single family, of course. So single family is largest, but in commercial real estate, it's multifamily. What most people don't remember is that until about the 2008 crisis, office was a bigger sector than multifamily. Because multifamilies, I remember still, you know, 15 years ago, 16 years ago, like you could buy a multifamily property for $40,000, $50,000 a door, right? Today, that property is, you know, $150,000 to $200,000 a door, right? So office was a much bigger sector. It was, and office people would always tell me, you guys are crazy doing multifamily. You guys are stupid. You're dumb. You know, your average tenant in a Class C property has $400 in the bank after paying their rent, right? My average tenant, and they were talking about themselves, has millions of dollars in the bank. And even if they don't use an office for a year or 2 years, they still pay it because they do not want to be seen as somebody that defaults on their lease. And so, you know, and you guys have to basically, for a 200 unit building, have to have 200 tenants. I have 3 tenants in a building that has the same yield. So those guys, they have this sort of upper class feel to themselves that sort of look down on all the multifamily people. Well, that's changed extraordinarily and drastically, because while multifamily has seen in this COVID era a maximum occupancy of 96.8% and a minimum occupancy of 94.8%, not 94.6%. So that's a 2.2% swing from, you know, top to bottom. Offices in the United States are now below 80% in occupancy, and offices in markets like San Francisco are in the 70s. So they have seen a fundamental demand destruction that cannot be reversed because of the fundamental changes. And a lot of people are like, no, a lot of companies, people have gone back to work. Of course they have. My point is, if a company was, before COVID, was giving you 1 day a week of work, and now they're giving you 2 days a week of work, that 1 day change means that their space utilization has reduced by 20%. They need 20% less space. So if the company had 10 million square feet of space, let's say Google in the Bay Area, now they need 8 million. Well, that's the fundamental problem. And so the office sector has been decimated. They're going to go through a decade-long apocalypse. And that apocalypse is extraordinarily slow, That's what's changed. It's very slow because most office leases are 5 years or 10 years. And those customers have lots of money. They're not going to default on a lease because, you know, the tenant can then take you to court because you're a functioning company, you're making money. If you default on lease, they can come after you. And they typically do come after you. So what's happening is that people are, the occupancy is dropping as leases come up for renewal. But San Francisco, I mean, shocking stuff. There's a property in New York, where a Canadian-based investment group basically sold their stake for $1 last week, a single dollar, because they're afraid of what will happen as occupancy continues to drop. So they basically sold their stake to somebody else for a dollar. And the person that's buying it, actually, it might be a terrible deal for them because they are now responsible for putting up additional cash if that property continues to bleed. Sure, they have a bigger chunk of the property, but they also have a bigger chunk of the liability. So these sorts of things are happening. Two buildings have sold in San Francisco, only two so far. Large buildings, they are famous buildings. So if you know you saw pictures of them, you'd say, oh yeah, I know this building. For 75% and one for 80% off their 2019 valuations. So these are changes, fundamental changes. The way we build homes are changing. The way that we do offices are changing because of COVID. And then, of course, the last and the biggest change, which has been discussed in your podcast many times, is this extraordinary rise in interest rates has meant that multifamily is at the highest discount level in its history, bar none. Even in 2009 and 2010, you could not find fully occupied, 95% occupied properties at a 25% discount. And that discount is available to anybody today in a market where unemployment is below 4% and the US economy just had an incredible year. There is no time since World War II that we can find an instance of multifamily being 25% discounted from peak in an absolutely high quality market with the stock market at all time highs. And the reason for that is COVID. Black swan events change the way that people think.
Mm-hmm. So where does that take an operator, an investor, an LP investor as well? There's a lot of room there for creativity then to utilize these new areas that have changed because of COVID. Are we starting to see people tap into that creativity of what can I do with that 20% of office space that's not needed anymore? How do I maximize on that? Or how do I change my single family home development process to align to the new work from home structure? Are you starting to see more of that kind of creativity pop up in the market now?
Yes. And you know, since I've already talked about what they're doing, you know, building office cubbies, I won't go into the single family side. That's really the biggest change that they've made. Office guys are screwed. So my analysis indicates, and this is actually usually when I do an analysis, I want to see if anybody else has done an analysis to see if I'm off. But it seems fairly straightforward. When you look at downtowns, the offices in downtowns tend to be extraordinarily expensive. So any kind of conversion would require a massive amount of money. Because remember, think about an office. And most offices in downtowns are rectangular, right? And sure, you can convert it to, let's say, condos. But condos legally require windows in every room. So you can convert the portions along the periphery into condos. But what do you do with the center? It's wasted space. And also, even though offices are down 70, 80% in San Francisco in some instances, that was just a worst case scenario, actually they're down about 20, 25%. When you look at the per square foot cost of offices throughout the United States, and you look at the per square foot cost of multifamily, they actually have to drop by more than 50%. So for a viable conversion to multifamily, because office square footage is so much more expensive, that we need to see a 50% drop for people to buy those offices and spend millions of dollars on them to convert them either to multifamily or to condos, and for that to be financially viable. So is conversion possible? Yes. Is it possible at today's prices? Almost impossible. Unless governments are subsidizing this, and I'm seeing, Chad, some activity where the governments in San Francisco and New York are talking about giving aggressive benefits to developers that are taking unoccupied office buildings and converting them, primarily in the property tax arena. And I've talked with a few people about it that do these kinds of things. And I've said, hey, you mean looks like the city is really motivated. Why aren't you doing anything? He said, Neil, it doesn't matter. If my property taxes were zero for the next 30 years, the cost of that office is still so high compared to what I would be converting it to. And the cost of conversion is so high. You got to cut the concrete. An office only has a single bathroom core. It's usually in the center, right? Well, an apartment requires you to cut the concrete and bring piping to every unit. He says, when I look at the cost, I can't make it work, Neil. I can't make the math work. So fundamentally, the answer is conversion, but it's going to take 5 to 10 years for conversion to make sense. So that strategy isn't working. The other change that COVID made, which I think is actually the most fundamental change since the last time I was on this podcast in 2 years, the most fundamental change is not in office. It's not in multifamily. The most fundamental change is in single family. So let me explain why. I mean, this is going to blow your mind. Pre-COVID, most people that had incomes in the $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year range were either in a single family home that they owned, or they were saving up for a single family home. And they had the ability at some point to become homeowners. They had the ability to do so, right? Most people, right? If they had the desire. And so the United States had an extraordinarily high home ownership rate compared to Europe or Japan or the UK or Canada, actually. So our home ownership rate was in the 60s, so somewhere between 62 and 64%. That's extraordinarily high. And the US was always known as the place where people that make 60, 70, 80, or 90,000. Obviously, it's a big range because I'm talking about places where some places, you know, home prices are much higher or lower than other places. So if you live in Cincinnati, you could easily do, you know, be a homeowner for 60,000. If you live in Austin, you might have trouble, you know, even with 90,000. So, but that was pre-COVID. Now, post-COVID, the entire United States changed because home prices went up by about 40 to 44% in the last 3.5 years. So think about when COVID started, March 2020 to now, right? So you're, you know, almost 4 years. In that time frame, home prices are up 40+%. And because of the mortgage lock-in effect, there's no decline in prices at all. No major market in the United States has seen decline in home prices because of the lock-in effect, right? When COVID happened, we dropped interest rates to zero, which meant mortgage rates were at 3%. So people like me refinanced. My mortgage is 1.75%. I'm locked in, right? My current mortgage is $5,000 a month. If I buy the same home today again, right, my mortgage would be $12,000. So obviously, I don't even get an upgrade, even though I have, you know, millions of dollars of equity in my home, and my mortgage still more than doubles. Well, that effect is happening to about 30 million American families. And so nobody's moving. And because nobody's moving, there are not enough homes in the market for prices to go down. So home prices are either flat or slightly, you know, 2% up. And I don't expect them to go down because now interest rates will start coming down in the next year. More people will flood into the market. That will establish a bottom. So we might not see increases in home prices, Chad, in the next 3 years, but we won't see declines. And the result of that is catastrophic for middle America. Those people that make $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, and $90,000 in homeowners income, nowhere in America can they buy a home. So here are some numbers, right? In San Francisco, it now costs $404,000 in median income to buy a home, right? And then in Phoenix, I mean, Phoenix was considered the, if you're leaving California, go to Phoenix and then you can buy a single family home and you can, you know, have a nice income. Well, Phoenix is now at $115,000 in income. So is Dallas. So Phoenix and Dallas are identical. Austin is at $126,000. So those places that people used to go to in Arizona and Texas and other places, they're all above $100,000. Orlando's above $100,000. In fact, the only major market in the United States that is now below $100,000 is Houston at 92. So still above the 60, 70, 90, 80, 90K people. At 92, you can buy a home in Houston. Your other cheap option for a major city is Atlanta at $177,000 in income. Bottom line, though, is, I mean, other than these two markets, there's nothing left in the United States where people under $100,000 can buy a home. And that is the single biggest fundamental impact of COVID, that we have marooned 20 million millennial families into forever rentership. We've marooned them in just 3 years and 8 months, right? These people had options pre-COVID. They had options because if they didn't like their city, they could go somewhere else. Today, you can't because that is the price of homes everywhere in the United States. 44% increases in 4 years US-wide. Some markets are up 50 or 60% from pre-COVID numbers. Some are even up 70% from pre-COVID, right? So the dream of homeownership is completely destroyed for mid-income earners. And that is the most fundamental change. And so I'll tell you what my solution to this is, and it's not apartments. It's not apartments. I love apartments. I will continue buying apartments. I will continue building apartments. But the solution to that particular problem is not apartments. So there's a lot of creativity being applied, and you know, we can talk about the sort of creativity that I'm applying.
I like what you're saying. I understand it. To me, the solution is either it's new build construction of affordable housing, but it seems like the answer there is never that it's profitable enough for builders to want to build it because they aren't seeing the returns on it that they would want if they went out and built a $500,000 homes instead that can't be affordable by this group of people. So is it an interest rate solution that we have to wait for that to come down to make it more affordable to get into those homes that are priced up now? Or will there be an income increase eventually in this economy and
well, the businesses? There's a 10-year solution, which is the income increase, right? So you have such a shocking gap, the median income is 75K. You need 115K to buy a home. $40,000, we're talking about a decade, right? So anything short of a decade, apartments don't work either because when you build apartments today, the cost of building has gone up so much and the cost of interest has gone up so much that the only kind of apartment that makes sense is a Class A apartment. And once you build a Class A apartment, you need a Class A income to live in it. Well, then you may be solving the problem for people making $90,000 or $85,000, but you're not solving it for the people that are making $55,000, $65,000, $75,000, right? The solution is that these people, because they're families and because they have dogs and kids, they don't actually want to live in apartments anyway. They want to live in single family homes, and they don't mind a very basic single family home. Remember, they were going to go buy a starter single family home before COVID. That home was probably, 1,300 square feet, three bedroom, and it's probably built 50 years ago. That was their solution. They want that. So the solution that I came up with, which shockingly works, the math works, is built to rent. And I was doing built to rent that was Class A, Class A plus, and I realized that that was wrong. So I made a hard pivot, and now 100% of my projects are Class B townhomes. I no longer build built-to-rent single-family homes because, once again, when you build a built-to-rent single-family home, you need that $90,000, $85,000 income to put tenants in. But if you're building townhomes without amenities, amenities cost a lot. A pool, a gym, a clubhouse costs a ton of money and a ton of land. And so what my solution has been is as follows. I asked my data science team to profile all 323 metros in the United States. And I said, I want you to find me metros that work on four out of these five things. They have to work on four, okay? The land must be cheap. The construction costs must be cheap. Property taxes must be low. Insurance must be low, right? So you got these four basic parameters, right? Land cheap. Construction costs cheap, insurance cheap, property taxes cheap. And then the fifth one is they must still have very significant growth, right? And only present cities to me that are four out of five with the growth one being non-negotiable, right? So if it's not growing, then I'm just not going in there. And we were able to locate about 12 metros where this works. And I know that's a shockingly small number when you're looking at 323 metros. I mean, the answer is most metros in the US construction costs have gone up too much. So yeah, that sort of kills a huge number of metros, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Texas gets completely destroyed just because of property taxes or insurance, both really.
No.
So do a bunch of other markets where either property taxes are too high or insurance is too high, right? So I mean, by a process of elimination, you're left with a dozen markets in the United States where either all five parameters work or four out of five work. And in those markets, I am able to build townhome projects. Still, single family doesn't work, too expensive. Townhome projects where I build clusters of townhomes that people live in. I've had to go down to one car garage because two car garages don't fit. And I've had to go down to a small backyard that's only 8 feet deep, right? So it's only an 8 foot deep backyard. It's only a single car garage. But every single person in these communities lives in their own home. It's a rental home. But here's the beautiful thing. The reason the math works at 20 plus IRR is simply this. There's very little turnover. No one leaves. In my brand new apartment complexes, 50% of people leave every year. Brand new, beautiful, infinity pools, clubhouses, gyms, 50% of people leave. And that's a nationwide statistic. But in my BTR, non-amenitized communities, the only amenity I put in is a nice central park, right? So where the water retention, it's really the water retention area, but I'm calling it a park. And then a little dog park on the side, and that's it, right? That's it. And maybe a little bit of extra parking if I can find some, you know, if the land's cheap. And that's it. That's all there is in these communities. They are a replacement for a single family starter home and nothing more. And because I'm only trying to do a single family starter home replacement, I'm building at a very reasonable cost. I do have a few things that are interesting. 9 foot ceilings, which is nice. I have granite countertops in the kitchen. But otherwise, it's just a regular home with a, you know, it's a regular townhome. And I'm able to consistently hit 20 IRR with today's construction costs, today's interest rates. Why? Because I basically walked away from all of my favorite cities. Well, actually, I have two out of 12, two are my favorite cities in the US. But if I have a list of 20 favorite cities in the US, I've been forced to get rid of 18, right? The only two favorite cities that fitted were Orlando and Raleigh. Orlando fitted because it's the only market in Florida where insurance costs are lower because it's never been hit by a Category 5 hurricane.
I was going to say, I'm surprised the insurance isn't high for Florida. I figure Florida would get knocked out.
It's the highest amongst our mission. I call this Mission 10K. So we're building 10,000 townhomes. And it's the highest amongst all Mission 10K cities, but it's much lower than any other Florida market because one thing that's not known about hurricanes is if a Category 5 hurricane hits, let's say Miami, when it hits ground, the air temperature changes. So it slows and it drops down to Category 3, right? So it is the edge of Florida that tends to get hit the most. Obviously, Orlando still suffers even though it's never really been flooded. It's never really taken a hit because overall Florida rates have gone up. So Orlando's rates are higher. But they're at the edge where we can make numbers work because Orlando still has very inexpensive land and fairly low cost of construction. So Raleigh is better where, you know, insurance costs are much lower. It's just normal insurance costs. I couldn't make land costs work within Raleigh, so I had to go 20 miles outside. So I had to basically go out into the suburbs of Raleigh, like Lake Forest, to make land costs work. And then, you know, population growth, obviously phenomenal in both Orlando and Raleigh. So I was able to make two cities work. The rest of my Mission 10K cities are cities that are not amongst my top 20 favorites. They're growing, like Indianapolis, Kansas City, you know, Northwest Arkansas, Reno. They're growing cities, but I wouldn't put them in my top 20 favorites. But it is my mission to build 10,000 townhomes in these cities for Middle America. If the townhome requires a 90K income, we walk away from that city.
Interesting. What's your attrition rates on your townhomes? We didn't get to that number.
We're losing about 20% of our tenants every year.
That's not bad then, comparatively.
And people in the trade know that attrition or turnover is the biggest killer of profit in real estate, right? So when I have a brand new apartment complex that I opened 2 years ago and it has 50% turnover, and then I have a community that is townhomes. I call these affordable townhomes. It's not an affordable anything project. I mean, affordable housing is a tiny little apartment in an old building, right? This is a townhome, right? Nobody lives above and below you. You've got your own garage. So you can't call it affordable housing, but it's affordable townhomes. People that are living in there, their incomes are actually pretty decent. So their incomes are in the 60s and my rents are below 2000. Because I'm not building amenities. And so they're able to afford those rents. So my rent increases go up with their income. So it is a for-profit initiative. There's no non-profit. There's no money from the government. There's no subsidies. But we're using data science to find those 12 markets in the U.S. where the math works.
Interesting. No, this is great stuff.
Left Field Investors is a community dedicated to limited partner investors who are interested in building wealth through real estate investing. The community is focused on education, networking, and engagement with quality operators and partners. We provide tools, webinars, and a forum where members can discuss everything related to real estate investing, including deals, operators, investment strategies, and much more. Coming soon, we're adding a new tool, sponsor reviews. This will be a place where our members can rate and review operating partners to further help each other in our investment journeys. Check us out at leftfieldinvestors.com. Visor provides investors with a secure platform that displays a comprehensive view of all of their holdings on a single, holistic dashboard. From real estate syndications to private equity, crypto to traditional investments, with AI-driven, unbiased, honest insights to maximize return, Visor is your one place to rule them all. Automating performance tracking, projecting future cash flow, analyzing all your financial documents, and much more in one powerful solution, making it easy to follow the money. Sign up for a free 30-day trial now at Visor.co.
I always like to bring our podcast back to the limited partner experience because that's our community. That's what we're focused on. So with all these things going on, office space turned upside down, multifamily going through its distress and so forth, single family being an issue. Talk to me about your take on, is it a good time to be investing in real estate? And if not, when is the right time? Is it now? Do we got to get into the metric driving aspects of this to really understand it? But should I be investing now or not? Should I wait? What's your take on that process?
I'll give you a straightforward answer. In the last 3 years, so I invest as a limited partner investor into other people's projects. One, because they're my friends. And two, because I learn a lot from reading their monthly updates, and it allows me to be better at my job because I realize that I'm not doing a bunch of things well by simply looking at what other people are doing. So I always have between $1 and $2 million invested into these projects. As money comes back from a project with profit, I just reinvest it. So I have not made any multifamily investments in the last 24 months. I am now going to be making at least a couple $1 million of multifamily investments, maybe 20 or 30 of them in the next 24 months. In fact, I might do $1 million a year for the next 3 years because I consider it to be a phenomenal time to invest. So what I did was, just to have fun with it, I assembled a 4-person team, okay? Just identical to the team I told you about at the beginning of this podcast. So there's, you know, a director of acquisitions, an underwriter, an admin, and, you know, it's a 3-person team with a floater as a 4th person. This team now presents to me every other week 6 opportunities. None of these 6 opportunities have any general partner scope for me. These are just limited partner opportunities. And out of those 6, I make an investment every week. So I made an investment last week. And I typically invest in 100K tranches, but because they're giving me so many every week, I'm investing in 50K tranches. So to me, as a limited partner, this is an absolutely stunning time to invest. You know, it's a phenomenal time to invest. I'm very motivated to invest in things. I'm not investing in things like office because they're, you know, that's a generational issue. You know, probably will take 10 years for it to stabilize. But places like multifamily, where today 25% discounts in good markets, right? I'm mostly investing in properties that have assumption loans because I tell people, one of the most unique and rare things that are available for investment today is that on the one side, prices are down 25% because of interest rates. On the other side, if you have an assumable loan that is at least 3 years, you are simply skipping what is causing that discount. What's causing that discount is one thing, high interest rates. So if you assume a loan, or you invest into a project as a limited partner, that's what I'm doing. I'm investing into people's loans that have assumable loans that are under 4%. So my threshold is I want to go invest in other people's deals that are under 4%. Obviously, I check to make sure that these deals are doing well, and any limited partner investor would do that. But what I'm saying is this is a amazing deal where you're getting the discount, but you don't have to deal with the consequences of that discount. So assumable deals, if they're not incredibly hard to find, are absolutely astonishing right now. And so I'm very, very, very happy to be able to invest. And so this Shark Tank session that I do, it's on Friday. So it's sort of at the end of my week. So 2 p.m. on Friday. And I've invited a number of my syndicator friends to it. The only thing I've told them is, no shady stuff. I don't want you to go and, you know, if you like a deal that I've underwritten, I don't want you to go and tell them, hey, I want to be a GP in this deal. This is LP only. Everybody here is a limited partner. We have a table on the screen that shows how much Neil has invested, what properties he invested in, how much has Michael invested in, how much has John invested in. And so this is a limited partner Shark Tank. You come in, you enjoy, we bicker over stuff. I can say stuff like, no, this is a property. Why are you investing in it? But nobody can basically take any general partner, you know, stuff out of it. And people have been so far very happy to do this. And so I'm very enjoying the process.
That makes for a fun Friday, I bet, actually. It sounds really good.
It's actually the best part of my week. And, yeah, you know, yeah. I'm investing my money. And I get basically pitched on 6 properties. And we're doing different properties. Like we just did, so we had a property that was a company that basically zones and entitles land and then sells it to builders. And because land is down 50%, by the way, in the US, you know, multifamily is down 25, offices are down 20, you know, self storage is only down like 8-9%. Mm-hmm. But land's down 50 because it's an illiquid asset class that doesn't produce any income. So, you know, so there's this company that seemed to be very good at their job that basically buys raw land and then entitles it, sells it to builders. And so we were, you know, looking at their investing in their deal. Then there was a company that does loans, like private loans. So we're looking at their deals. Then we looked at 2 pref equity deals, because right now I think pref equity is absolutely phenomenal. And then we were looking at a couple deals that were just, you know, multifamily. And the week before that, we looked at industrial, we looked at self-storage. So just, Chad, I'm having fun. I think this is an incredible time to invest. I'd be shocked if I don't end up investing a couple million in the next, you know, 12 months.
Interesting. Now, that's good to hear. It does seem like it's at that point as a limited partner. A, operators have been exposed that aren't doing the job well, so we have fewer to pick from, so we can rely on who's left a little bit more. But B, there is that kind of rescue fund model going on out there now where people are having trouble with their loans, being able to assume them to a new operator that can get it up and running. That does make it seem like a good time to be an LP investor at this point in time.
I'll give you a really nasty tip. And this tip is only for LP investors. And the GPs that are watching, please do not send me nasty emails, because Chad says that his database, the people listening are LPs. So if you listen as a GP, that's your problem. I'm going to give a nasty tip. Okay. So here's what as an LP, I think the best deal right now going is a certain kind of pref equity. Okay. So what's happening is there's high quality operators. You know, these are the people with billions of dollars in portfolios that, you know, they had bridge loans, they got stuck, right? So what's happening is that because they're high quality operators and their track record is so important to them, they're taking properties that are, you know, basically just have to be refinanced. And once they're refinanced, there's really no money for anybody except the pref equity people. There's no money for the common investors. Those guys are just stuck. And they're refinancing for 5 years, right? So it's a 5-year refi. It's a big operator. And what I want you to look for, which is what I'm looking for, I won't name the exact operator, but I think you guys can find this operator. So this is an actual example. The operator is Houston-based. And so they have a portfolio. What the properties are nice. There's nothing wrong with the properties, but they were purchased at peak time, right? And so because of that, their values dropped about 30%. So they're going through a refinance process. And what they're doing is they're basically putting in 5 to 8 million in pref equity in each property, of which they're putting in 3 million, right? Which is why I'm very interested in this. So they're putting in 3 million of their own money into every property. And then they're raising 5 million in pref equity. And when I do the math, and I have an underwriter doing this, so that when I say I'm doing the math, somebody is doing it for me and I'm paying them. By the way, I pay people on Upwork to do this. So I hire people on Upwork that are underwriters. I pay them $30 an hour, and I basically have them. There's an incoming LP funnel because I'm doing this as a limited partner, and they are looking at like 30 properties every week, and they're basically picking six to present to me. So my underwriter basically is instructed to make sure that there's plenty of money for the pref tier, which I'm going in as part of the pref tier, right? And it's a five-year loan, meaning they can't get out in less than 5 years. So it's not a short-term pref equity deal where they basically give you money for 18 months and then kick you out, right? Those deals are phenomenal because this operator is very good, is not going to let the property go down, and I'm only investing in pref equity by switching the property from bridge to perm. So the property goes from negative cash flow to positive cash flow in a second, and my money doesn't go in until that switch occurs, which is the closing of a bridge loan. Now the property is trapped in the sense that they can't get out for the next 5 years because, you know, these loans, they have prepay penalties that are very, very high. So unless the market just doubles in price, you can't get out, which means that my pref equity is going to be in for 5 years. So I'm going to sit here and make 5 years of pref equity, double digit returns, even though the property is distributing $0 in cash to any of the common equity, right? And because these are operators that have a huge amount of money, so much money that they're putting in $2 million of pref equity into this deal, well, they can't let this property go down because they just put $2 million of personal cash into it, right? I'm looking and investing in all of those deals. And everything that I said to you is ethical, right? It's truly, truly ethical. I'm just doing my homework and saying, I want that operator that has made so much money, they're worth $50 million or more, and they're putting millions of dollars into pref, refinancing, locking in for 5 years. For 5 years, this property is going to make $0 for that GP and $0 for the common investors, but yeah, it's going to make me 12-13%.
Yeah, well, there's your black swan event. I mean, this would not be occurring
this
if all these other things.
Impossible. Yes, impossible absolutely. 4 years ago.
That's great.
Firstly, there would be no deals out there. Today, there's hundreds. Right. Mm-hmm. And 4 years ago, pref equity was 7 or 8%. Mm-hmm. Today, pref equity is 12, 13, or 14%. Black swan. In a great market with unemployment at 4% and the U.S. GDP growing at 2.5% and the stock market at all-time high, black swan events create more unusual investing opportunities, right? So,
absolutely.
I mean, I know I'm a general partner, but I'm just here to talk about, as an LP, I'm looking at it going, and pardon my French here, but why the f*** would investors not want to invest in this market?
Right, right. No, you bring up a very excellent point of taking advantage of the current times and where we are with all these things that have been going on that feel very negative. As an investor, there are avenues that are very positive right now.
And
I think
more
that's
positive
great.
Than 2 years ago. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're buying a building or investing in a building that's 25% cheaper.
No, yeah. Which, when are we going to get that opportunity again?
Never, right? I mean, yeah, you might get it if unemployment's running at 8% and we are in a depression, but we're not even at 4% unemployment, right? And now the Fed actually can cut interest rates because inflation's down to under 3%. So, I mean, it's a Goldilocks zone for investors. They don't realize it, though. I mean, when I talk to 10 investors, 9 of them are very gloomy. You know why? Because the last 18 months, all they've seen is no cash flow and cash calls. Right? Yeah, so they're really gloomy. And my feedback to them
picture.
Is, what does that have to do with today?
Yeah. Yeah. Look at the next one.
Right? What happened in the last 18 months was because you invested in properties when they were 25 or 30% more expensive.
Exactly.
What does that have to do with today?
Yep.
Right?
Nope,
this
that's
is
a great
the same thing where people in 2006, 2007 bought extremely expensive homes, lost a bunch of money, and then completely missed the window from 2009 to 2012. Didn't buy anything.
Yeah.
Right, I was buying a single family home in cash every month for 3 straight years, and everyone in my family told me that I was the biggest idiot in history. I was banned from family events because I would infect other men in the family who would talk about real estate, and so I was not allowed to go to family events.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, it worked out really well because I ended up, with $4 or $5 million in equity out of that. Because it made me mad, and it made me want to prove my point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're right back in what looks like a situation to deal with something like that again.
From so it's hard to, yes. It's, from an economy perspective, no. I mean, you know, unemployment, fair. When I was buying, unemployment was 6 or 7%.
Yeah.
The economy was doing terribly and nobody wanted to give us loans. It was, you had to be really brave. Why do you have to be brave today? I mean, you're buying at 25% under discount. Your properties are 96% occupied. Where's the bravery? Yeah. It's just math. It's just logic.
Yeah. That gets back to the metrics of it. Neil, this is great. I've kept you too long, but I really appreciate you coming back on and sharing your nuggets again. We always ask at the end of these favorite podcasts. You said you do 2 podcasts a week all year long. There's got to be some favorites in there. If you could mention one of your favorite podcasts, we'd love to hear that too.
You know, I should have a better answer for that particular question, but no favorite podcasts at this point in time. I would like to invite people to my group. We don't do podcasts and we've never done one. We like to do webinars because I'm a charts and graphs math kind of guy. And it's very hard to do that in podcasts. So we do webinars, 8 of them every year. All of them have charts and graphs. And so for people that are analytical, that you love them. And we store them at multifamilyu.com. So that's multifamily followed by the letter u.com. There's no subscription. There's no upsell. There's no premium membership. There's no coaching. There's no teaching. Just go there, you know, take a look at the data and enjoy it. The big benefit that I receive is several thousand people send me graphs, charts, and data throughout the year, which I gather and I learn more. So I get a tremendous financial benefit out of it.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. Last thing I'll ask you is where can people reach out to you and touch base?
I think the best place is actually multifamilyu.com. That's the right place to start because I tell people, you may like what I'm saying in this podcast, but you should not be in a hurry to invest with me. You don't know enough about me. You've just listened to me for 30 minutes. Join my community. Come to our webinars. You know, take your time. I'm not saying that today is the best time to invest. In fact, I'm on record saying that the best time to invest in multifamily is Q4 of this year, the fourth quarter of 2024, not the first quarter of 2024 when we're recording this. So don't be in a hurry. And, you know, join the multifamily community. When we do our webinars, we take 60 seconds to tell you about what it is that we are up to. And so if that seems interesting, you'll have a chance to, you know, to look at it.
Well, take the time to get educated right now and be ready for when that next market comes around and you're ready to go. So, Neil, this is great. Again, thank you for coming on. We appreciate always getting to spend some time with you. So thank you.
Thanks for having me back.
You bet. And thank you, everybody, for listening in.
Have a deal in mind and a group of investors ready to go? Use TribeVest to pool your capital together through a multi-member LLC. TribeVest has streamlined the group investment process, making it easy, quick, and safe to do business with others. Start a tribe and invite your partners to join. Then you can use the platform to collaborate with your partners, pool capital, and manage your joint investments. I'm in 12 tribes myself. It is a great way to learn from others, spread risk, and get into deals at lower minimums. Go to TribeVest.com to get started today. Investing in syndications can be a daunting task. Wiring a large sum of your hard-earned money to someone you talk to on the phone for 30 minutes can certainly be scary. How can you be confident in what you're doing? Steve Sue, one of the founders of LFI, just published a book called Avoiding Rookie Errors as a Left Field Investor. 20 lessons learned from 14 years of investing in private syndications. This is by far the best book I've read on syndication investing. It's an easy to read book, chock full of great advice from Steve's experience as a passive investor. It is a must read. Whether you're a first time passive investor or a veteran, go to www.leftfieldinvestors.com/books and click on the link to Avoiding Rookie Errors as a Left Field Investor. If you are a passive investor, you got to read this book.
What a great conversation with Neil Bawa. Neil always brings some energy, some excitement, has great tidbits to share. I do enjoy listening to him talk at conferences and getting on podcasts with us because it's you never know exactly where it's going to go, but it's always some good tidbits. I liked how he talked about how COVID has been a black swan for several different cases. It's had a lot of fundamental changes. He talked about how it's impacted home building and how office space is being incorporated in homes a lot more frequently than it used to be, knowing there are more people working from home this day and age. He talked about how hurt the office industry has been and the drop of 20% potential usage of those buildings, and then how people are trying to utilize that change in their market for the benefit, but struggling to find an area to do that yet. It's going to be a while, probably, before office space really picks back up again. And then interest rates, obviously, this is almost, we're all on leap day. This is leap day of 2024. And, interest rates are a big discussion all the time. Remains to be seen where they're going to be, but everybody's kind of assuming we're on our way back down over the next few months. Hopefully that's the case. I liked how he talked about the most fundamental change that he's seen since COVID has really been around the single family market, and how the market went up so quickly that it really has created this situation where there's a lot of middle class buyers that cannot afford space. And that has spawned this market of the build to rent model that we've seen here at Left Field from a few different operators. Neil's putting a lot of attention to that too. But I liked how he even brought up how he's focusing more on Class B build outs. So fewer amenities to be able to fit that income bracket that these people really need, so that he can tap into that group, that market that's really looking at it. And what he was focused on was, cheaper land, cheaper construction costs, cheaper property tax, cheaper insurance, and still growing, and how few markets really fit that criteria. I think he said he only came up with 12 MSAs out there that really have that area anymore. Very interesting to understand how small that market might be for that group of people, but there's so many people in that group that really need the places to live and so forth. And then talking to him about whether it's a good time to invest or not. I liked his attitude of now's a great time to invest as a limited partner investor. But he was very specific about looking for pref equity type structures because of how unique they are by getting the discounts on what multifamily has dropped because of the interest rate costs and so forth. And then being locked in to being a pref equity investor as opposed to a common investor. Very interesting, very good feedback. As always, we really appreciate Neil coming on every time he makes it here, both times. So hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks for hanging out in the Left Field with us today. If you are interested in becoming a left fielder, you can find us on the World Wide Web at www.leftfieldinvestor.com and click the subscribe button to join our community. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the show on your podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you really enjoyed the show, a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts would be appreciated.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said on the show should be considered financial advice. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Passive Investing from Left Field and Left Field Investors. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.